We will be having a full night of learning here in Yeshiva with Shirim, and the entire community and public is invited to attend. Tonight, we are honored to have Rabbi Krohn, who is in our original series 11 years ago. He was our original speaker of this series. So it's a great privilege that we have Rabbi Krohn back. Tonight, our shir is being sponsored by Benji and Chani Lanner in memory of Rabbi Moshe and Rebbetzin Miriam Lanner. That's Harav Ben Yaakov, Harav Moshe Ben Yaakov, and Rabbanit Bat Meir and Ari Newman, who's Aaron Chaim Ben Shimon Shlomo Halevi. I believe that was a classmate, or that was Rabbi Krohn's Rebbe from Torah Vadas many moons ago.
What's his last name?
Rabbi Lanner.
Yes, sure.
He was his principal. Also, we'd like to thank Autumn and Bruce Mail and family in commemoration of the third yahrzeit of their father and grandfather, Mordechai Simcha Ben Yaakov Tzvi. Shavuos, one of the memories, one of the images that are seared into our brains of Shavuos, is that of a mountain being held over our head. And it seems like there was much coercion. It's forced, almost a dark image, potentially. But there's a beautiful medrash that compares the mountain being held over the head of Klal Yisrael to accept the Torah, and it compares it to Yonasi Bechagve Hasela. It compares it to a dove who was underneath the cleft of a rock. And what is the comparison between Klal Yisrael underneath the mountain accepting the Torah and the dove who goes underneath the cleft of the rock? So I heard from Rabbi J.J. Schachter, where he explains that why does a dove go underneath the cleft of a rock? Because it's hot. There's need of shade. To cool off. So you have to imagine Klal Yisrael at the time they were about to receive the Torah. It's this time of year. They were in the Midbar. It was hot. There was no air conditioning. And then the Kaddish Baruch Hu, in his ultimate act of kindness, a Torah's chesed, he takes the mountain and he places it over Klal Yisrael's head to express to them that this is the Torah. This is the most beautiful and comfortable thing in the world. This is Torah's chesed. This is something that will give you physical pleasure, but mostly spiritual pleasure. Similar to that dove when he goes underneath the cleft of the rock, so too Klal Yisrael, underneath the mountain, they understood the beauty and the warmth that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was going to provide to them through the giving of the Torah. When you think of Rabbi Krohn, this is one of the thoughts that comes to my head. He has an amazing way of presenting Torah in a beautiful way. Something that is so sweet and something beautiful and is inspiring and makes you want to accept the Torah because of the warmth that is being given over. It's my pleasure tonight to introduce Rabbi Krohn, who is going to speak about being there for others, becoming a source of blessing. Thank you, Rabbi Krohn.
It is a great schus to have been invited once again to come to speak to all of you. I thank Rabbi Storch, I thank the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Kamenetsky, and as Rabbi Storch mentioned, I hope we'll be able to be inspired together. There's a very interesting question that many Mefarshim ask, and that is, why do we not make a Brocha Shechiyanu when we begin counting Sfira? We know that any mitzvah that you do periodically, whether it's sitting in the sukkah, lighting the Hanukkah candles, or reading the Megillah, we say Shechiyanu, because we are happy that we've lived to this period in our lives. So why don't we say Shechiyanu? So there are numerous reasons that are given. One reason, the last Ran in Psochem gives a reason, and he says that we only make Shechiyanu where there is total Simcha. But over here, as soon as we say the words, Sfiras HaOmer, a person can think, oh my gosh, the Omer, we're supposed to bring it if you have a Beis HaMikdash. We don't have the Beis HaMikdash. And so therefore there's a tinge of sadness when you begin to say Svir Asa Aimer. And that's why, in my opinion, why right after, what are the first words that we say after we count Svira? We say, Harachaman, Hu Yachzir Lanu Es Havoides Beis HaMikdash L'mkayma. Hashem, the compassionate one, bring back the Beis HaMikdash in its place. Why all of a sudden are we davening for the Beis HaMikdash? And the answer is, I believe, because here we just said about Svira Sa'aymer, and we're thinking about the Beis HaMikdash, and we have this tinge of sadness, so we say, Hashem, bring back the Beis HaMikdash. However, the reason that I want to focus on tonight is what the B'nai Yisoschah brings. The B'nai Yisoschah says, Ki ein hachuka al hayomim hanisparim. The main thing that we are waiting for is not these days of Sfira that we are counting. Rak hayom sha'acha yimei ha-Sfira. That day of Shavuos, which is after the days of Sfira. That's what the culmination of joy is all about. Oz mevorchen shechiyonu. Because he says the idea of Sfira is just leading up to that holy day of Shavuos. And that's when we're going to say Shechiyonu. And he brings something very interesting. He said, if we are waiting for Shavuos, and that's the day that we're so excited about, so imagine if I told you won a $50 million lottery, and you were going to get it in 49 days. How would you count? 48, 47, 30, 25. Remember before we got married, how did you count? 5 months, 3 weeks, 6 hours, and 10 seconds, right? Down, 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 until you finally come to the wedding itself. I mean, I don't know what happened after the wedding, but basically before the wedding, we're so excited. And we're counting down, right, till we come to that. And if that's the case, so why don't we count down from 49 to 1? And the answer is, because we're supposed to get higher and higher and higher. These are days of growth. That's why we have a kinnus like this. That's why we get together every year in this period of time, because we're supposed to grow. So what are we supposed to grow? How do we grow? And in which way? So I'll tell you something fascinating. Again, from the B'nai Yisoschah. I want to share with you a very interesting Mishnah that at first glance seems very simple. The Mishnah is in Ovos. Mishnah Bey, Perit Beis, Mishnah Tes. Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai is sitting with all his Talmidim, and he says to the Talmidim, guys, what do you think? What's the most important midah that a Yid should have? Eze, Derech Yishora, Sheyid Bak Boha Adam. What is that right midah that a person should attach himself to? So one Tana said, Rebbe, I think every person should have an Ayin Toiv, a good eye. Don't be jealous. There are a lot of people out there that have more talent than you have. There are a lot of people out there that have more money, more nachas. Be happy for them. Don't be jealous. Have a good eye. Another Tana said, Rebbe, I believe a person should be a good friend. We all have acquaintances. But how many of us have a friend that you can call 24/7? They'll always be there for you. You have to learn how to be that friend. And different people said different things. And finally, Rebbe Elazar ben Aruch says, you know, Rebbe, you know what I believe? I believe every person should have a lev tov, a good heart. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, you know something? You are so right. Because everything that anybody said, it's all included in having a lev tov, having a good heart. Fine. Nice Mishnah. Simple. Well, you should all have a good heart. Watch what the B'nai Yisoschah does with this. It's unbelievable. All of you know that every letter in the Jewish alphabet is an equivalent of an American value. So how much is the word lev equal? 32. How much is the word toiv equal? 9, 6 and 2? 17. 32 and 17 is how much? 49. That's what the 49 days of Sfira are. The B'nai Yisoschah asks, why don't we have 59 days? Why not 39? Where does 49 come in? And he says, 49 is the lev toiv. That's what we have to learn tonight. How to become that lev toiv. And it's interesting, after the first 32 days of lev, 32 days of Sfira, what begins? Lag Boimer. Lag Boimer begins the days of Toiv. And that's what we're going to learn tonight. How to become that person of Bracha. How to become that Lev Toiv to be thinking about others and not only ourselves. So I want to share with you a magnificent story. Something that shook me to the core, and I absolutely cannot believe that people who are involved in this story are sitting here tonight. I had no idea that they would be here. My wife is from Denver, Colorado. I have always had a great love and a reverence for a man named Rabbi Yisrael Rosenfeld. His son, Rabbi Meir, is sitting right here.
Rabbi Shlomo Rosenfeld was in Denver, Colorado, and he started the Hillel Academy. Eventually, my wife was one of his students, and eventually Rabbi Rosenfeld not only taught her numerous years as the school got bigger, but eventually Rabbi Shlomo became the Menahel. And today my wife is one of the principals at Chevach High School, and she always says, I always looked up to Rabbi Rosenfeld. He was my role model of what it meant to be a principal. So over the years, I've had the schus to do many of Meir's boys, which are Rabbi Yisrael's grandchildren. And this past June, he calls me up from Denver, and he says, you know, I had my first great-grandson. Could you please come to the White Shul, and you'll do the bris? I'm going to be flying in from Denver. I said, Rabbi Rosenfeld, you know, I'd do anything for you. What's the question? I'll be thrilled. And so that morning, I came early to shul, and Rabbi Rosenfeld, I see him there, we embrace, and he says, I want to show you something. I want to show you the becher that we are going to use, the kiddush cup, that we are going to use at this bris. It's so special to me. So I said, why is it special? He says, you know, because when my parents got married many years ago in the town of Chust in Hungary, the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel, he gave this kiddush cup, this becher, he gave it to my parents. So it's very special to me. I said, wow, very nice. He says, no, but there's much more to it than that. He looks me straight in the eye and he says, do you know that I was in Auschwitz? I said, what are you talking about? I thought you're from Denver. He says, no, I came to Denver as a young married man already. And he rolls up his sleeve and he shows me the numbers on his arm. He says, let me tell you what happened when I was 15 years old. When I was 15, we were living in the town of Chust, and suddenly the Nazis, Yimach Shemon, surrounded the city, and it became a ghetto. Nobody was able to get in, nobody was able to get out. And a rumor started that we were going to be deported. And Rabbi Yisrael tells me my father was convinced that we were going to be deported deeper into Hungary, someplace deep into Hungary. But no one could have imagined that we would end up in Auschwitz. So I said to my father, I was only 15, I said, please, no matter where we are deported to, they will not let us take the valuables of the family. Please let me take some of the valuables. I'll bury them, and maybe one day we'll come back for them here. And my father agreed, and I took four things. I took the atara of my father's talis. I took my mother's leichter, my mother's candlesticks, my father's pocket watch, and the becher. And I ran around behind my grandmother's house, where there were chickens there, the earth was soft, I dug with my hands as deep as I could, and I put in those four things. The atara of my father's talis, my mother's candlesticks, the pocket watch, and the becher. And I covered it up. And 4 days later, Rachmana Litzlan, we were taken to Auschwitz. We were there a year and a half. My father was killed, my brothers were killed. The only ones that survived were me, my sister, and my elderly, frail mother. After a year and a half, we were liberated, but my mother could hardly travel. And so my sister took care of her. But I wanted to come back to Chust. I wanted to see the home that we lived in, and I wanted to get the items if I could. And I ran into the house where we grew up. And the goyim that were there said, get out of here! If you don't leave, Jews have no place anymore in Chust. This house is no longer yours. I'll call the police. And Rabbi Rosenfeld says to me, I wasn't even 19 years old yet. I was terrified. I didn't want the police against me. So I ran quickly behind my grandmother's house and I tried to imagine, where is that becher? Where did I bury everything? And I figured that it was in this place that I took a piece of wood, because now the earth was hard, and I started digging and digging, and there this stuff was. I saw the atar of my father's talis, the leichter, the candlesticks, the pocket watch, and the becher. But the becher was on top, so it was flat, because people had trampled on it, not realizing what it was. And we took it to a silversmith, and eventually, we remolded it, and this is the becher that we're going to use today. We've used it for every bris in the family, for every wedding. And today, it's going to be used for my first great-grandson. I said, let me have this becher. And I kissed it, and I said, please, give me the becher before the bris. Today, I'm going to speak before the bris. And before they even brought in the baby, I told everyone the story that Rabbi Yisrael Rosenfeld told me. And I said, I believe this becher represents Klal Yisrael. This becher was stepped on. It was trampled on. It was given up for dead. But here it is, right in its beauty. And that's what we all are. Klal Yisrael's been thrown out of so many countries. We've been thrown out of Spain, thrown out of Poland, thrown out of Europe, trampled on, stepped on, buried, given up for dead. But look at us! 100,000 at Asim HaShas. Look at the school. Look at the yeshiva. Look at all the yeshivas in the world. Today we're stronger than ever. More people learning. More people doing mitzvahs. This Kaisha Bracha represents all of us. This Kaisha Bracha represents Klal Yisrael. And I said to everyone, it would seem to me that after the bris, everyone should line up. And we'll all take a drink from this Kaisha Bracha. And we'll pour the wine. And everybody should take a drink. Because this cup of blessing represents Klal Yisrael. And sure enough, after the bris, a long line, more than 20 people, everybody lined up. And everybody was drinking from the Kaisha Bracha. And you know why that's important? Because the Torah tells us something amazing. Two words that we should never forget. When Avraham Avinu is asked to leave his father's house, Hashem says, "V'eschol v'goy gadol, I will make you into a great nation. V'avarecha, and I'll bless you. V'agadol shemecha." And listen to these two words. V'heyei bracha. Rav Shamsul Fulhir says that many people teach it wrong. They think it means you'll be a blessing, you'll be rich and famous. That's not what it means. This is the mantra, he says. This is what every Jew, starting from Avram, was supposed to be. Heyei bracha, become a blessing. Become a source of inspiration. Become a source of chizuk. Help other people. Don't only live for yourself. Live for others. Become a blessing to Klal Yisrael. That's what we're here tonight for. How can every single man, woman, and child in this holy Beis Medrash learn tonight how to become a Kaisha Bracha? And I'm going to show you how. Every single one of us. I want to tell you a story that many of you may know the first part, but surely most of you don't know the second part. In January of 2009, there was a plane that left LaGuardia Airport. The captain of the plane was Chesley Sullenberger. Sullenberger sounds Jewish, but he's not. He was going to Charlotte, North Carolina, flight US Air 1549. All of us who have flown know that it takes less than a minute to get out of the runway of LaGuardia over the George Washington Bridge. But by the time Sullenberger was over the George Washington Bridge, he realized that he had no power in his plane because the engines had been immobilized because there were two flocks of birds that were sucked into the engines and he had no power. And he realizes that. He's just coasting. He's got no power. And he radios back to LaGuardia, "I've got no power, I've got to land this plane." And they said, "Just turn it around, we'll close the entire airport, nobody will move. It'll be a lockdown, any runway you can make it to." He says, "I don't even have enough power to get back." Imagine, he's less than a minute away from LaGuardia and he can't make it back. So they say, "Okay, go to Teterboro, just coast. With the thrust that you have, coast to Teterboro. It's a small airport in New Jersey, again, we'll open it only for you." He says, "I can't even make it there." So now he had two choices. Either he could land the plane on one of the streets, the West Side Highway or one of the streets of Manhattan, and he would kill all 150 on board and probably kill many people on the street or the highways, or he could try to land in the Hudson River. Now he knew that the only way that you can land a plane on the water, that it should be safe, was that if both wings hit the water exactly at the same second. It had to be perfectly level. Because he's a great aviation historian, and he knew that there had been other pilots that tried to land in the water. And they didn't land the plane. Even one wing hit the water first, it snapped off, exploded, and everybody was killed. So with great concentration, and with great skill, and great Siyata Dishmaya, he said three words: brace for impact. You can imagine what it was to be on that plane. And the captain says, "Everyone, brace for impact." And again, with great skill and great siyata d'shmaya and great concentration, he landed that plane absolutely perfect. The plane, both wings hit the water the exact same microsecond. It coasted for a mile and it stopped. To me, the greatest picture ever taken. And you've seen it going up and down Rockaway Turnpike. They've had it for a while. All those people standing on that wing. If I was on that wing, I would have slipped right into the water. I can't understand how those people were not frightened on that freezing January, 20 degrees in the freezing water, and just didn't slip off that runway. But he saved everyone. So many people know this story because it appeared in all the media all over the world. But what most people don't know is that they brought him back January 2010 on the anniversary. And he stood along the Hudson River and they interviewed him. And they said, "Captain Sullenberger, relive for us that moment. How in the world did you not lose yourself? You knew you had 150 lives in the balance. Where did you get that concentration? Where did you get that control to be able to land that plane so perfectly and not be overcome by what was going on? Listen to what he said. It's going to change your life forever." He said, "When I was a little boy, just beginning my teens, the one that I loved the most in this world was my father. I loved him so much and he loved me. And then, in a terrible way, which I can't describe in a Beis Medrash, his father was killed." He said, "When my father was killed, I was so lonely. I was so frightened. I had such anguish. I sat and cried day and night. I never thought I'd get over it. But as time moved on, and I moved into my teenage years, I swore to myself that for the rest of my life, I would make sure that no one, if it was in my power, would ever go through the Gehenna that I went through. That loneliness, that fear, that anguish, I would do anything to make sure that nobody would go through that. And as I was flying over the George Washington Bridge, all I could think of was my father. All I could think of was that if I don't land this plane perfectly, there will be not hundreds, but thousands of people related and friends of these 150 people, children, spouses, parents, that will go through what I went through. And I was going to do anything in my life to make sure that no one would feel the pain that I felt." And that's how he became a Kesha Bracha. And that's how all of us can become a Kesha Bracha. Because every single one of us here has gone through challenges in life. And the obligation for all of us is to look back at our lives and see the challenges that we've gone through and think, you survived it. You somehow made it. You overcame it. Go out and reach those who are going through what you went through. Somebody who went through a health problem can help somebody who's going through the same health problem. But you can't help the guy who's going through a financial problem. There are many problems. We can't solve all of them. No one person can solve all of them, but every one of us can solve some of them. Whether it's financial, whether it's family, whether it's health, whether it's shidduchim, people go through situations of challenge. Every one of us. This is gullus. Nobody gets away scot-free. Look into your life. What did you overcome? How did you overcome it? And go out and put your arm around the person who's going through it and help them and tell them, listen, I went through it, I survived, you'll be able to survive. I want to give you some examples. I have a friend in Golders Green in London who has the worst job in Klal Yisrael. You know what the worst job in Klal Yisrael is? Being the head of a tuition committee for a yeshiva. That's the worst. And you know how you get that job? You don't show up to the meeting and people vote you in. So, that's what happened. I don't have to tell you what it means to raise money. It's difficult. Right? Everybody's got money for the SUV and for Disney World and for hotels and everything. But when it comes to tuition, I just don't have it. It's like, you know, when I come to a bris, right? You all know I'm a moyel. So the guy's got a DJ. He's got a photographer. And he's got a caterer. It's like a wedding. And he's bargaining with me for the bris. I said, excuse me, sir, look around. You know, he said, "Oh, my in-laws and my father paid for it." I said, "Yes, yeah, so maybe you'll have them pay for the bris." "No, that's my mitzvah." So I tell him, "Because it's your mitzvah, I got to suffer." You know, like, what's going on? So, you know, same thing with tuition, right? Somehow they got money for everything when it comes to tuition. So he tells me that there was this fellow in England who had a child in the school, he's very wealthy now, and he owed £2,000 to the school. Of course, pounds are dollars. It's very important to know that. You know, I'll tell you something that happened, but of course has nothing to do with the speech, but I can't resist. When you go to a foreign country, it's very important that you know the vernacular of that country. See, there was this English chassan that was married to an American girl, and it was the week of Sheva Brachas, and she came down, you know, the night of Sheva Brachas, she looked great in his beautiful dress, and this guy from England says, "Man, you look great! You look like 1,000 pounds! It's not what you want to say to a Kala who's an American girl, right? But anyway, so this guy owes 2,000 pounds to the school. So he calls him up and he says, listen, you know you owe the money. We got to pay the rebbeim. We got to pay the teachers. We have so many bills. Please pay before Yom Tov. He says, I'm so sorry. I realize I've been negligent. I'll come this afternoon. I'll come to your house. He says, okay, I'll wait for you. He waits a whole afternoon. The guy doesn't show up. He cannot believe it. The guy said he's going to come. How could he not come? The next morning again, he waits for him, and he doesn't show up, so he had to borrow money for the bank, so he could be the rebbes and the teachers and everybody would have money for Yom Tov. He doesn't want to call him before Yom Tov because he just doesn't want to get into an argument with him. But after Yom Tov, he calls him up. He says, I don't understand you. You promised that you were going to come. I was waiting for you. How could you not come? He said, what do you mean? Of course I came. What do you mean you came? You didn't give me no money. He says, no, you have to live on a very tight street. I came there. I couldn't park, but I saw your son, your seven-year-old son. I gave him an envelope with 2,000 pounds in it, a white envelope, and he said he's going to go in and give it to you. He said, what are you, crazy? You give a seven-year-old boy an envelope with 2,000 pounds that's unmarked? It's ridiculous. He said, but he was standing in front of the house. He said he was going to go in and give it to you. He says, I don't know what you're talking about. I'll go ask my son. He hangs up the phone. He goes, finds his son. He says, do you remember a few weeks ago somebody gave you an envelope? Daddy, I don't know what you're talking about. He calls the fellow back. He said, look, I don't want to take it to the Torah, but you got to admit, you did something that was so negligent. You give money to a little child, and you don't even call me to say that you're outside. What's going on here? The only thing, before I take you to Din Torah, I'm going to go up and down the block. There are many from people on the block. Maybe somebody found it. He goes house to house to house. He knocks on one door. He says, excuse me, sir, did you find an envelope a few weeks ago? He said, what do you mean, with 2,000 pounds? He says, how do you know? He says, you're not going to believe it. He says, it was a few days before Yom Tov, right? He said, yeah, exactly. He says, I had just been laid off my job. I had just been laid off. I did not know how in the world I'm going to tell my wife we have no money for Yom Tov and I don't have a job. I was just walking up and down the block. I could not build up the courage to walk into the house. I'm walking near my house. I see a white envelope, unmarked, 2,000 pounds. I thought, what else could it be? Unmarked, on my lawn, right before Yom Tov, when I just lost my job. So of course, that's what we use for Yom Tov. But now that you tell me that it belongs to Hegdish, it belongs to the yeshiva, what's the question? Of course, I'll pay you. I can't pay you all at once, I still don't have a job. But I promise you, I'll pay you in increments, I'll pay you back. Well, the guy is so happy, he calls back the wealthy guy, and he says, you'll never believe what happened. He tells him the whole story. Listen what the wealthy guy says. Tell him he can keep the 2,000, I'll bring you 2,000 later today, which he did. He said, I know what he's going through, because I went through that a number of years ago. I was without a job, humiliated and embarrassed. I understand what he's going through. Tell him he can keep the money. That's a kesher rah. When somebody goes through a problem and is able to reach out and help another person because he understands the pain and he understands the anguish, that's what it's all about. You know, I'll give you another example, something that so many of us are involved with. And it's very, very important that we should be sensitive to the issue of shidduchim. We all know, especially in New York today, it's a very, very difficult problem. Thousands and thousands of young men and women, wonderful people, somehow cannot find the right one, who they feel is the right one. And so many who have children of this age go through difficult times until they're able to find the right one for their child, or till the child themselves finds the right one. But any family that has gone through that, or any young man or young woman who had to wait until they were a little bit older to find the right mate in life, has the achrayas to call those that are still looking and say, listen, let me tell you how I did it. Whether it was with tefillah, whether it was a bracha, whether it was networking, making calls, calling your friend, whatever, however you did it. Everybody's got a story. Call these people. They're lonely, they're frightened, they're worried. They just look cool and calm on the outside, but they want to get married. They want to build families like all of us. Who's going to help them? If you haven't gone through that, you can't feel their pain. So I want to tell you a story about a girl named Reggie. I happen to know this Reggie. She was married to some Israeli guy. They got divorced after 2 years. She moved back to Detroit, where she comes from, and then she came to New York. And she moved to Kew Gardens. And I have a son, Eliezer, who was her son, Dave Ron. And we became very close. The two families became very close to the point when my wife and I, we were the ones who made the bar mitzvah for Ron. This woman, Reggie, had very, very little. She struggled with parnosa. And again, she was looking for a shidduch. She was in New York many years, and nothing happened. So she goes back to Detroit. She's going to live with her parents. She just can't find the right one. By now, she's close to 40 already. And one day, she calls a shachrita in New York and says, listen, you know, is there any way that you could read a shidduch for me? And she says, yeah, I have somebody for you. Good. She's coming to New York. While she's in New York, she figures she'll call another shachrita. Who knows? Maybe she can go on two different dates, right? While she's here already, she came to New York. So the second one says, what are you looking for? Tells her, oh, I got a guy for you, but you got to go out tonight. She said, I can't go out tonight. I got a date already. No, but he's only available tonight. No, but I got a date already. I can't cancel just because you have somebody for me. So the shop says, you know, many of these women are very nosy. So she says, who are you going out with? Nah, I don't want to say. Come on, you can trust me. Right? You called me, right? So she says, oh, okay, I'll tell you who I'm going out with. She mentions the name of the guy. And the shotgun says, we me! She said, what do you mean? No, it's okay, don't worry, it's fine, you can go out with it. What are you, crazy? You know, you'd say, oy vey, what's going on? I told you, so now you better tell me. All right, she says, I'll tell you. The reason he got divorced from his first wife is because he beat her. This Reggie is a short little petite woman. She's thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going out with this guy who beat his wife? Now she surely can't cancel, right? It's 2 hours before the date. Listen to this. They go out, they're on the highway. He asks her, you got any hobbies? She says, yeah, I'm a black belt in karate. The date ended 25 minutes later. But it's not fair. It's not fair to rent a shit up like that. Of course, people are going through difficulties. Just because he's a man and she's a woman, it's not a reason that you should read that shit up. So I brought a gift for all of you tonight. This is a very special gift. It'll be outside. It's free. It's been sponsored by somebody who had gone through this problem of an illness and understood what illness is all about. And this is a DVD that my dear son-in-law Hananya Kramer of Kol Ram, he and I put this out together. It's how to do Bikur Cholim and how not to do Bikur Cholim. For example, somebody comes to visit somebody in the hospital and says, oh, that doctor that you have, that was the doctor of my aunt, Oliver Shalom. Well, that was the doctor of my grandmother who suddenly died under his care. That's not what you say to somebody who's sick in bed, whether in a nursing home, or in their own home, or in the hospital. And you don't bring somebody a gift. You know, the Asham Lubagadlo, you know, the vidui that somebody says before they die. Don't even bring it in a frame. That's not the gift you want to give somebody when they're in the hospital. But I want to tell you, besides the skit that's very funny that's on this, there are six extraordinary Rabbonim that speak directly to the Chayla, and all of you know two of them. Rabbi Eitan Feiner, I don't have to tell you what he's gone through, but what most people don't know is what Rabbi David Weinberger went through in his own personal life. The illnesses that he's gone through and the operations. And he speaks directly to the Chayla. You cannot believe how much chizuk and invigorating it is to listen to him. Whether a person is a Chayla, and especially so, take one for somebody that you know that's not well. The others are Rabbi Raymond Beda, Rabbi Eisenberger from Brooklyn, Rabbi Simcha Lefkowitz, many of you know him as well, and Rabbi Warren Goldstein, the chief rabbi of South Africa. It's fabulous. Again, if you've gone through a hell situation, you can help someone. I know a couple of years ago, unfortunately, was the night of Simchas Torah. I was walking in the street in Yerushalayim with my wife. We were going to watch Hakafas. My grandchildren had gone ahead of us already. And believe me, I have no idea how this could have happened. But I slipped, and I fell, and my knees were no longer attached. I don't know how that happened. A small fall. And I ripped the quadriceps in both my legs. I couldn't move. I'm not going to bore you with all the details. I was in the hospital overnight. I checked myself out of there the next day because I didn't want to be operated on in Eretz Yisrael. I wanted to be only in New York. And after Yontif, we came back here. The only one who could give me chizuk, the only one, with somebody in Pittsburgh. I just happened to meet him this week. We had spoken on the phone numerous times. He too had ripped his quadriceps, and today he's jogging and he's doing wonderful. So a fellow who had a heart attack cannot assure me that my quadriceps will be fine. And a person who's had a kidney transplant cannot really be the one that can tell someone who ripped his quadriceps, listen, you're going to be okay. I went through it. I understand. It takes 2.5 years until you're going to be able to jog again. And that's what Bigur Cholim, that's what being a bracha is all about. So I'll tell you something. Today I could laugh at it. But believe me, when I was in the hospital, I could not laugh at this. A guy calls me up and he says, oh, Rabbi Krohn, it's wonderful what happened to you. I said, what are you talking about? What am I, a kapara for Klal Yisrael? He says, no, because now everybody can say, Pesach fell on Sukkot. So today I could laugh at it. If he was in front of me, I would have thrown him out the hospital window. So that's not what you say to a guy who's a chayla. So I want to tell you about one more type of organization. And what does it mean when somebody feels the pain of other people? This Shabbos, I'm going to be at a Shabbaton you should never, ever know from this situation. There's a wonderful organization called Samchenu. Samchenu is for widows. This organization, without exaggeration, has 700 members. Women in their 20s, 30s, all the way up to their 80s. You can't imagine what it is to be at such a Shabbaton. To try to give chizuk to these people. Rabbi Yaakov Bender comes because both he and I lost our fathers at relatively young ages. My mother was the quintessential almana. She was the quintessential almana for 40 long years. She never got over the passing of my father. Rabbi Yaakov Bender can tell you stories about his mother. So, being that I saw all the years what it means to be lonely and what it means to be an almana and what it means to be dependent on your own children, I can relate to those women. So this week I have to speak on certain topics, stress management or whatever. But somebody that didn't lose a parent, somebody that didn't live with an almana, cannot feel their pain. Again, what we have to do is look into our own lives and see what we've gone through and try to help these children. These adults, whatever they may be. So I want to give you some examples of what it means to be a Kosha Bracha. There was a fellow in the Gates at Yeshiva. Very, very funny guy. 19, 20 years old. He had learned in the Yeshiva for 3 years. And now he was going to Eretz Yisrael to learn. So many of you know that in the Beis Medrash, when a guy's been there for a number of years and he's leaving Eretz Yisrael, so they make him what's called a Sudas Preda, a goodbye party. Now this guy was a character. Everybody knew that his speech at the Sudas Preda is going to be something to remember. But nobody imagined what he would say, how it would make such an indelible impression. The Rosh Yeshiva is Rabbi Avram Gurowitz. So he spoke, the Mashgiach spoke, the boys Chavrusa spoke, and then he got up to speak. And he said the following. He said, I would like to tell a story about the Rosh Yeshiva that the Rosh Yeshiva himself doesn't even realize. He said, we all know that he's a great Talmud Chacham, but I want to tell you what kind of great tzaddik he is. And he tells the story that he had just been in the Yeshiva for 2 or 3 days. He said, I just came 3 years ago. I didn't know anybody. I had 1 or 2 friends here. And somehow we got into a fight. And they were chasing me. Now, I didn't know the layout of the school or the Beis Medrash. It was lunchtime, so I figured I'd run into the Beis Medrash. And, I could be there. Nobody's going to beat me up in a Beis Medrash. But in the Beis Medrash, there were a lot of guys learning there. It was lunchtime, but there were still many people learning there. I couldn't hang around there. I didn't want to get into a fight with them in the Beis Medrash. So I ran through the Beis Medrash, and in the back was an Eitzah Sforum, a library, without windows. I slammed the door shut, locked it. These two guys come running after me. They're banging on the door. Let us in. I said, what are you, crazy? I'm not going to let you in. You guys are going to beat me up? No, we got to buy her a safer. Go, you my foot. You don't have to buy her no safer. You just want to beat me up. Get out of here. I'm not opening the door for you. So the guy says, okay, I was in the room for a few minutes. Then there's a knock on the door. I say, who is it? And there's a soft voice says, it's the Rosh Yeshiva. Yeah, the Rosh Yeshiva. You're not the Rosh Yeshiva. What do you want? I need a safer. Yeah, my foot. Yeah, I'm not giving you a savior. You just want to beat me up. Okay. He said, I was there. And a few minutes again, there's a soft knock on the door. I said, who is it? It's a Rosh Yeshiva. Come on, I told you before. Get out of here. You're just imitating the Rosh Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva is probably home. Don't tell me that story. You just want to beat me up. He says, I need a safer. Come on, you don't need a safer. You're big on Amoritz. Okay. A few minutes later, there was a knock on the door. And he said, oh my gosh. I was thinking, maybe it really is the Rosh Yeshiva. So he said, I opened the door very slowly. And I see the Rosh Yeshiva standing like this. And he walks in as I open the door, and I ran out of there. But the Rosh Yeshiva hid his face so he wouldn't see who I was. And I wouldn't see his face. And he said, Rosh Yeshiva, I want to tell you something. If you had walked in regular and seen my face, I would have left the yeshiva the next morning from humiliation. But because you validated me, and you made sure that I would not be humiliated by my silly mistake, that's the reason that I was able to have wonderful years of learning here in the yeshiva. That's a kaisha bracha. A kaisha bracha is somebody who validates another person, who makes someone feel special. That's one of the primary lessons we have to learn as we become the late third. You know why? Because these are the days that the 24,000 Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva died. Why did they die? Because they didn't give covet one to the other. So I ask you, is that a reason to die? Everything that Hashem does is midah keneged midah, measure for measure. Nobody killed anybody. Nobody ate Yom Kippur. Nobody drove on Shabbos. So what is the pshat here? Why did they die? And the Maral says something fabulous. The Maral and Yevamos Samach Beis and Beis writes, Kasha Adam Noyeg Kovid L'Chaveira. When you give kovid to your friend, Dovar Zeh Hu Etzem Achayim. That's the essence of life. Imagine you walked into this Beis Shmedes tonight. And not one person said Shalom Aleichem. Not one person said a word to you. You have a couple hundred people here. Everybody's doing something. And nobody looks at you. You figure, Lama Lichayim, what do I need in life? Nobody cares about me. When you validate someone, you give them covet, you give life. When you take away covet from someone, as they did, you're taking away life. That's why they lost their lives. So whether it's a spouse, whether it's a child, or whether it's an employee, sometimes we have to criticize, but it has to be with derech eretz. It has to be with sensitivity. That's what being a kosher bracha is all about. Just because you're the parent, or just because you're the rebbe, or just because you're the employer, doesn't give you any right whatsoever to berate another individual. You could berate their actions. People do stupid things, that's for sure. And you have a right to criticize the action, but not the person. I'll tell you another thing. What does it mean to be a kosher bracha? All of us know that one of the worst things that ever happened in the history of New York was when that little boy, Leiby Kletzky, from Borough Park, was nebuch kidnapped. 9 years old, coming home from a summer camp, we all know. Now, to me, one of the greatest pictures, besides that one of all the people on the plane, on the wing of that plane, to me, one of the greatest pictures ever was the young fellows looking for Leiby Kletzky. You had a guy with shorts. You had a guy with a kippah suga. You had a guy with an upturned hat. You had a guy with tzitzis down to his knees. You had chassidim, misnagdim, ashkenaz, sfardim. Everybody was looking for Leiby Kletzky. That picture was fabulous. That brought out the achdus in Klal Yisrael. So Rachmana Litzlan, when everybody found out what happened, and they knew that Nachman Kletzky, the father and the family, was going to sit shiva, I could not make up my mind whether I should go be Menachem Avel. On one hand, I don't know the family. But on the other hand, this was the Torah of Klal Yisrael. Everybody was down. Everybody was involved. We were all caught up in it. How in the world could you not go be Menachem Avel? So I drove to Borough Park. I found out where the house was. It's a long line of people. The security officers are there. Everybody move, move, move quickly. Just come around, say, I'm looking Menachem, and you're out. So that's what I did. I stood online, walked around right in front of Nachman Kletzky. I say, I'm looking Menachem. He says, hey, wait a second. I said, what do you mean? He says, I know you. I said, you know me? He said, yeah, my son Leiby, he used to watch your videos on Tisha B'Av. He said, sit down, I want to talk to you. And from that moment on, Nachman Kletzky and I became very, very close friends. As a matter of fact, when they had the Matseva, he only wanted a minion. That was one of the 10 people that was there. But he says to me, go, talk to my wife. Please. This was my only son. I have 4 daughters. Go, talk to them. I'll get everybody out. You just talk to them. So I sat with them. And then I left after a while. Later that afternoon, a woman comes to Mrs. Kletsky and says, Mrs. Kletsky, I want to thank you for something. She says, what do you want to thank me? She says, I also have a 9-year-old son. And 3 months ago, he became rebellious and he stopped wearing his tzitzis. And nothing that my husband and I could do would make this boy wear his tzitzis again. We tried to give him gifts, he didn't want. We tried to punish him, it didn't help. Begged him, pleaded, garnered, nothing. Rebellious, yeshiva, summer camp, he's not wearing his tzitzis. A few days ago, he comes down and he's wearing his tzitzis. And I said to him, I'm so happy, what made you put on your tzitzis today? So he said, I'm wearing them so that they should find Libby. And then for 2 days, he wore them. And then the third day, we found out what happened. And I didn't know what to say to my son, because he also knew what happened. And I was wondering if he's going to come down with his tzitzis. And sure enough, that morning he did come down wearing his tzitzis. So I want to thank you, Mrs. Kletsky, she said. It's only because of your son that my son has gone back to wearing his tzitzis. Listen to this. A few weeks after this incident, obviously Mrs. Kletsky told her husband Nachman, Nachman calls this family. He calls the mother and he calls the little boy. He says, please come to our home. And Nachman told me when the little boy walked in, he touched his head and he gave him a kiss. And he said, this kiss is not for me. This kiss is for my son, Libby. He says, sit down, I want to talk to you. And he sits the mother down and he sits the little boy down and he says to them, I want to tell you, you can't imagine how much it means to us that you are wearing the tzitzis so that they should find my son. It's so precious to us. And then he takes Libby's tzitzis, the tzitzis that that little boy Libby wore, and he gives it to this boy. And he says, here, it's now yours. Wear it. L'zecha nishmas, my son. Every single day, including this morning, this little boy, who now I know, and his mother, every day, he puts on his tzitzis, and he says, L'zecha nishmas, Libby Kletsky. That's a kosher bracha. Here's a man who lost his ben yochid, his only son. And he's not thinking about himself. He's thinking, how in the world can I give chizuk to another person? How can I do something that will make an indelible impression on the beauty of a mitzvah and on the beauty of thinking of somebody else? That's what a kosher bracha is. So I want to tell you one more story we'll review and end with a great thought. In Brooklyn, there was a fellow, his name was Yossi Pressburger, 47 years old, a tremendous bal chesed, everybody in Flatbush knows him, or knew him. He was in Detroit. He worked for Kedem Wine, never had a heart attack, and he passed away. So the family called me. I don't know them, but they know that I became a Yosem at a young age, so they asked, please come and speak to the children. So after I spoke to the children, I went to the kitchen to talk to Mrs. Pressburger. She's Taka going to be at this Shabbaton. She's been there before already as well. It's very crowded, very tight, and there was a woman there. The woman didn't know Yossi. She knew the wife. And she said, you know, it's very crowded here, but just tell me something about your husband. I didn't know him. Tell me something about him. So she says, I'll tell you about my husband, Yossi. He always did a chesed right away. He never waited. If somebody called him, he said, I'm here. I'll do it for you. He didn't say, I'll get somebody else. I'll do it tonight. I'll do it tomorrow. Right away. Fine. She says, thank you very much. I'll try to remember that. And she leaves. She drives three blocks, Avenue N and East 19th. She told me, she was at the light, it was, had to have been after a snowstorm, so there was only one lane of traffic. On the corner there is the Communist Yeshiva. She sees a woman is sleeping in a car. Now, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so obviously she's coming to pick up her son. But she said to me, there was something about that woman, the way she was sleeping, that I felt something is wrong. Now, I just heard, 5 minutes ago, you got to do a chesed right away. So I figured, you know what? I can't get out of the car. There's cars behind me. I'm going to call Hatzalah. And I apologize. I called the guy in Hatzalah. I said, please forgive me. I may be wrong, but I've got this feeling that there's something wrong with a woman in the car on East 19th and Avenue N. And the Hatzalah guy says, never apologize to Hatzalah. That's what we're here for. If there's even a chance that somebody could be a victim of an illness or something, call us. We'll be there. She told me she drove away. An hour later, she gets a call. Are you the woman who called Atzala? She said, yeah. She says, I want you to know you saved that woman's life. She was in diabetic shock. You were right. She had hypoglycemia. If she would have been there another 20 minutes, she could have died. She couldn't believe it. 20 minutes ago, she had just heard, not 25 minutes ago, she had heard do a chesed. And so she decided, okay, I've got this gut feeling, I'm going to call. And she saved the woman's life. And then she calls me 3 months later. She says, you'll never believe it. Today I got a call from the mother of the woman who was in the car. She said, we've been waiting 3 months to call you. You didn't save one life, you saved two. My daughter was expecting a baby, and today she had a little girl. That's what being a Kodesh Avroch is all about. Not thinking about yourself. We've come tonight in the days of Sphira. As the B'nai Yisoscha says, this is a time for growth. As the B'nai Yisoscha teaches us, Leiv Toiv, 49. That's what we've come tonight to become a Kodesh Avroch, like that Becher of that Kiddush Cup of Rabbi Rosenfeld. We've been trampled on, we've been stepped on, but we're here stronger than ever. And if Hashem gives us the capacity of life, we have to listen to what He wants from us, which He said to Avraham Avinu, Vayei Bracha, become that blessing. Let's become that blessing like Captain Sullenberger. Look into our lives, the suffering that we had, and how we overcame that, and make sure nobody else goes through that. Whether it's that fellow who gave the money to the poor person, gave him the $2,000, or whether it's somebody who's gone through Shidduchim, be sensitive when you read Shidduchim. Let's be careful with Bikur Chaylim. Take this, it's free tonight. The books and the tapes that are out there are not free, but this is free. But let's remember, be a Kodesh Avroch, validate, just like Rabbi Avraham Gurewitz did, just like Nachman Kletzky did, just like that woman who went and made that call to Hatzalah. I just want to end with this thought. Many of you know that ever since 2003, and this young woman sitting right here was right on the first trip. Remember, we went to Lithuania together, 120 people. These trips literally change your lives. And it's fascinating. This year we're going to Greece. You're all invited. July 29th. Fabulous trip. But a couple years ago, they asked me to take 100 people to Italy. And I was thinking, what in the world is in Italy? What Jewish history is there? And of course, once I started doing the research, I saw it's incredible. The Ramchal, the Mesillas Yesharim was born there. The Bar Tanura, the commentary on Mishnayos, he was born there. Sforno was born there. The Or HaChaim lived there. If you read Or HaChaim every Shabbos, you'll see he wrote his parish in Livorno in Italy. He loved those people. If you would take a look at the Hagdama of the Or HaChaim, you'll think he's writing about the Mafia. Every one of them ends with an I or an O. All these people who supported him. All these Italians. He can't believe their names. It's unbelievable. All Italian guys that were wonderful people. So, but I knew that the last day of the trip, that was going to be the most memorable. Because that was the day I was going to take them to the city of Rome, where they have, in the whole area of the Roman ruins, they have the Arch of Titus. You can look it up tonight in Google, and you'll see the Arch of Titus is so imposing, over 50 feet high. And to me, it always bothered me. Why did Hashem allow that arch to remain in its perfection? You walk around the city of Rome, so many broken buildings, and they're proud of it. Columns that end no place, stairways that lead no place. But they're old buildings. That's the ruins of Rome. But why did Hashem allow this? And you know what? You know what's so painful? You take a look, there's an engraving, you can see it, of Jews walking out of Yerushalayim. And what are they carrying? They're carrying the menorah. Why did Hashem allow this? It's such a disgrace to all of us. Yidden being sent out of Golas, killed on the way, killed in Rome, building the Colosseum. And then I told him that in 1953, the Ponovich Yerov came there. And he looked up and he said, Titus, Titus, you were the one who killed and destroyed the second base Hamikdash. You thought you would last forever. Today there's no Roman Empire. Today there's no Titus. Nobody's talking about you. But my brothers and sisters, we're flourishing. We're in Eretz Yisrael. We're all over the world. And then I told him the story about a correspondent. A Jewish correspondent who came to write about Hadrian's Wall. Hadrian is Hadra Yonis in the Gemara. He was responsible for killing Rabbi Akiva. And that wall is in the northern part of England, near Newcastle on the River Tyne. And he came to write about the wall, and he sees the wall is not significant anymore today. People are picking off stones from it. There's no holiness to it. There's no significance. So somebody comes over to him and says, yeah, you're a Jewish guy. You know there's a Jewish neighborhood here? He says, there's Jews up here in Newcastle? He says, yeah, in a town called Gateshead. And they bring him to the house of the Rosh Hashiva, Rav Leib Gurowitz, the father of Rav Avram, who had hit his head. Rav Leib Gurowitz and Rav Abishol Solomon told me, he remembers the day that this happened. Rav Leib is talking to this fellow, he realizes the guy knows nothing about Yiddishkeit, he says, come here, I want to show you something. And he brings him into a Beis Medrash like this. He brings him into the Beis Medrash of Gate. This guy was never in a Beis Medrash before. Guys yelling, screaming, big books, little books, on the shelves, all the shelves. He says, Rabbi, what's going on here? He says, you came to report about Hadrian. Hadrian doesn't exist. The Roman Empire doesn't exist. But Rabbi Akiva, who Hadrian killed, these guys, they're debating what Rabbi Akiva meant. They're talking and trying to figure out what Rabbi Akiva meant. And not only that, there are dozens and dozens of places around the world where they're still talking about Rabbi Akiva. And then I told the people, that's why I believe that Hashem left that arch there, because it's a lesson for all of us. They're carrying the menorah. They started a journey after the second Beis Hamikdash. What does the menorah represent? Kiner mitzvah v'torah or. Every mitzvah that we do is a candle. Every word of Torah that we learn is the true light of Klal Yisrael. The only way we can continue that journey from the exodus of Yerushalayim until Mashiach is if we carry that banner of Ner Mitzvah V'Torah Or. And that's what we prepare for as we come to Shavuos. To make a commitment to do mitzvahs as we've never done them before. To make a commitment to learn Torah and to support Torah, because that's the real light of Klal Yisrael. Hashem should help in these wonderful days of growth before Shavuos. We should learn how to become that Kodesh Bracha. Learn how to become that Leif Taiv and make a commitment to their mitzvah of a Torah Or, so that when we come to Shavuos, we can say with feeling and excitement, Shachiyono v'kimono v'giyono lazman hazeh. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for listening. Yes.